Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the world look like, sound like, and feel like from the perspective of an ADHD brain? More than 1 in 10 American children between the ages of 4 and 17 had been clinically diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder by 2011. Students with the condition are present in nearly every K-12 class these days, and most educators are aware of its effects. My guest this hour was diagnosed in the mid-80s, when ADHD was less omnipresent than it is today. In addition to the challenges of coping with a brain that worked differently from those around him, he also grew up with stigma and even some outright hostility from peers and teachers alike. Timothy Denevi is a nonfiction visiting writer in the MFA program at George Mason University and author of the new book, Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. Tim, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me on.
Some of your earliest memories are of these tantrums that you would have as a little boy, where the emotions you experienced were so overwhelming that whatever had triggered them became almost beside the point. Can you describe for us what they felt like?
That's a good question. And that's part of what I started to, part of the reason I started to write the book, because thinking back to early moments in childhood, when I was sitting down to do writing on this, I remembered these specific instances when it was as if the world itself would disappear and the emotion I was feeling would blot everything out. And that was such a different feeling than I experienced in comparison to adulthood, where that emotion is no longer as extreme. And one of the things I remember is not just the degree of the emotion, but also the moment that emotion would subside and roll back. And suddenly the world would surge forward to its normal place that the emotion had previously been taking up and blocking out. And it was, in a sense, these transitions at the very earliest moment of memory to very heightened emotion and then back to what felt like reality that struck me in a narrative way when I went back and was trying to understand why I continued to remember these memories and why they stuck out for so long. We're talking about when I was 5 or 6 years old.
I really it was very troubling to read about these tantrums that you had, and yet it's helpful, I think, for people who maybe would look at children in particular acting out because of ADHD and thinking, well, that child is simply, has not been parented appropriately or hasn't been taught the right way. This was not something that you were in control of, and it wasn't really even attached to the thing that you might be upset about.
That's a very good point. I think that for the last 100 years and even longer, when we've talked about something like overactivity or inattention or a degree of difficulty with impulsivity, we've talked about it in terms of willpower. And trying to articulate how I felt when I was younger, I remember at those moments wanting more than anything to not have what's going on happening, because most often something like that excessive emotion or overactivity or impulsivity in the classroom led to an enormous amount of conflict. Eventually, that's what I would see, is the upsetness, you know, the anger or the confusion of these people in the circle around me. And I really wanted to avoid that, because that was obviously a very unpleasant thing. And eventually, I was just getting better at fighting with other people as opposed to getting better at doing math or getting along with the student next to me. And despite my desire and like a very strong willpower to not have those outcomes continue to arrive, I still found them in some ways unavoidable. And that distance between desire and reality, you know, what I wanted reality to be and how it was one of the key aspects of childhood that I remember now, which, again, childhood's a very powerless place for a child. You don't have control over your environment, you know, the way you do as an adult. It's a different space.
You had fights and fights and fights as a kid, and you write about the fact that ADHD can cause kids to mature more slowly academically and socially than their peers, at the same time that they're suffering from low self-esteem and then social isolation that comes along with it. It's really a formula, you know, for a lot of trouble.
It sure is. One thing I found in my research about this book, I wrote most of the personal narrative first, and then I spent a long time reading the literature from the past 100 years on the issue. And this, often a good way to characterize ADHD is with two degrees of symptoms. The first symptoms are what we'd say are the ones we think of when we think of it, which are impulsivity, overactivity, and attention problems. But if those are causing conflict all the time, then we're going to see some secondary issues where the child is having a tough time not just with their own behavior, but with the way everybody responds back to them. So eventually, I wasn't just having a problem sitting still in class. I was also having a problem getting along with the people who were upset with what I was doing. And so sometimes when I had experiences with doctors or adults or my parents that were trying to help, we would focus on sitting in a chair or thinking about what you say before you say it. And other times, I had a wonderful psychologist, and she would focus on how I responded to the way people were responding to me, because that's an enormous source of conflict and harm right there.
I thought it was really sweet in your, I guess, middle school years. You focused a lot on what you wore to school and would like beg your mom to buy you the coolest clothes because you were hoping that that would make you fit in a way that you hadn't been able to socially.
You know, I'm pretty lucky growing up as a white male in the middle class at the end of the 20th century. I had an incredible amount of advantages. But because of this behavior, I still did feel like an outsider, you know, many times. And many times my behavior did make me separate from other people and make me more noticed and make me more, especially in those lovely years we refer to as our preteen and teenage.
They're not pretty years, for anybody.
Exactly. Make it very difficult. And if you could just find something, I wanted an abstract. If I could just find something that would confer onto me a kind of anonymity around the rest, whether it be like a cool Adidas jacket, you know, or it be the haircut I always wanted, or it be the baseball swing I could never quite get, then suddenly that would take the place of this omnipresent thing that I think I would be on. And I'd, you know, be on a date when I was 12 years old and be like, okay, say the right thing, don't do this, and then suddenly I've spilled popcorn all over. And everybody has that experience. But for me specifically, because of all the other conflict that came from it, I did wish there were abstract, external things that could suddenly replace the identity that was always coming to the surface in my case, which was ADHD.
When you were very young, you had this vague sense that something was wrong. You were being taken to, you know, see psychiatrists at Stanford, but you couldn't fully understand it. Was your diagnosis explained to you in the beginning?
You know, originally they thought that ADHD in the 1940s was something called MBD, minimal brain dysfunction. And so by the 1980s, most doctors weren't using that term because it implies that there's something wrong with your brain, like it's been hit, it's had trauma to it. And I think that term was used with my mother by the older doctors that she was working with, and they didn't take time to explain very clearly what was going on with me to her, or to see it in an individualized manner. And because of that, I kind of got filtered information on what was happening all the way through to when it got to me as a six-year-old, I had to get an EEG at one point where I had to stay up all night. And I thought they were actually going to be looking to examine the damage in my brain with the EEG. You know, I had no idea what an electroencephalogram is now, which is a reading of the way, you know, the electricity in your brain. And so at the time, that kind of game of telephone that goes all the way down and really started with the pushiness and imperiousness of these specific doctors. We had wonderful doctors later at other times, but with my mother then, and caused a lot of harm and still sticks out as a misconception that at the time felt so real.
Yeah, the idea that your mother was essentially led to believe that you had low-grade brain damage, is that accurate?
Yeah, because the term, I mean, she knew that nothing had happened, but because the term, terms have a lot of power. You know, they confer a sense of what's going on in a way that we always kind of carry with us. And so when she heard minimal brain damage, MBD, which is what this overactivity used to be called a long time ago, I think that stuck with her. And at the time when I had to stay up all night before I got the EEG, because that's what they needed to do to see the brain patterns in the way they wanted, I thought that the machine, when I was 6 years old in the corner of the hospital I went to, was going to actually read my brain. Hmm. And it was, you know, terrified. And I had been up all night and was a mess. But I think part of that has to do with the way the information originally got communicated. And one of the things that we hope to do better now when it comes to something like ADHD is communicate in as clear a way as possible what we know. You know, even if we don't know as much as we'd like to know, at least communicate that through its terms, through its diagnoses in the best way we can.
How do the brains of ADHD patients differ from neurotypical brains?
I mean, that's a good question. ADHD is very, very difficult to know because we're dealing with something at the border of biology and experience. And so it has a high heritability, I found in my research, in my reading. over 60%. I mean, it's inherited. It's almost like eye color, but it's often about experience that makes it different. And so researchers like Dr. Xavier Castellanos have found discrepancies in ADHD brains, but we're talking about development too, a developmental disorder. So a five-year-old can always seem hyperactive to an eight-year-old, but the question is, how is that five-year-old different than other five-year-olds? So brain studies are very difficult, not just because it's hard to actually do them and find out what's going on with them, but because we're dealing with something developmental. One of the best things I came across when I was reading was the question of, is the human brain too complex to figure out its own complexity? Hmm. And I was very struck by that, especially in consideration with ADHD.
Timothy Dinevi is my guest. He is a nonfiction visiting writer in the MFA program at George Mason University and author of the new book, Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project-management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Timothy Dinevi. He is nonfiction visiting writer in the MFA program at George Mason University and author of the new book, Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. You could be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tim, what did you learn about the history of giving stimulant medication therapy, maybe the world's most counterintuitive medical treatment, to patients of ADHD?
Well, it was very interesting in that it was discovered accidentally in 1937 when a doctor in Rhode Island who was running a hospital for children, many of which were suffering from overactivity and other attentional issues. Some of this had been caused by their struggle with the encephalitis epidemic, and some of it may have just been ADHD also, but he was trying to figure out what was going on. And one of the things he did was he ran a pneumoencephalogram, which is basically a spinal tap, and it was a very painful procedure. And afterwards, he was worried the kid's blood pressure was dropping. And so as a result, he prescribed them a stimulant, benzedrine, thinking that it will help with their blood pressure. And instead, what he saw was that suddenly they were able to complete certain tasks and interact in certain ways that they had completely been unable to before. And he was shocked by it and didn't really understand. And so he wrote a long article about it in the American Journal of Psychiatry that he's actually dramatized. You know, most of those articles are pretty dry, and they're even from the distance of now, they're pretty hard to read. But I was struck by the way that he genuinely questioned what was happening. You know, he didn't understand it. He wasn't looking for any answers or fitting them with any ideology. He just basically asked, like, I don't understand why a stimulant, it's counterintuitive that a stimulant, he'd said, that would actually make children more calm within their bodies, basically, is how he went about it. And he basically ended it with saying that we'd like to see more study into this, but there wasn't really that much more until the 50s and 60s.
You were prescribed Ritalin when you were very young to deal with your symptoms, and you had a terrible reaction to it.
Yeah, it went poorly. My mother would tell you if she were here that we don't tend to respond well to medication in our family anyways. Like, she'll say that she is sensitive to it from her experience. And she tried to articulate that to the doctor because she had seen in the past that I'd had a tough time on simple things like Benadryl. And he didn't really listen in her telling of it and from what I could remember. And so I'd been given too much, I think, of Ritalin. And I had something called a rebound effect where I was so agitated when it wore off that eventually I started waving a butter knife around. And from what my family's told me and from what I kind of barely remember, because it was a very strange emotional space, I threatened to kill myself with the butter knife at 6 years old. And, you know, my mother, I was 40 pounds. She grabbed me. The knife dropped. She called the doctors. They didn't call back. And eventually she went in. And even when she went in to talk to the pediatrician about what had just happened, she remembers how he couldn't quite get his head around the fact that maybe things weren't fitting toward what he thought the path of them should be. He's like, well, maybe we can break the pill in half. And she just looked at him and said, you're not listening to me. And so from then on out, we tried some other paths instead of stimulants. But I don't think it was the stimulant. I mean, to argue, it may not have been the stimulant itself that did that, but this rebound effect. And even now in adulthood, I do take a low dose of Adderall, of stimulants. And it's always interesting to me to think about what happened then at the very cusp of memory and to be on the other side of it now dealing with something similar.
The first school that you attended was a Catholic school, and you had mixed experiences. We'll talk about the more negative ones later, but it seems like the first couple teachers that you had provided what today would be called accommodations that seemed to have worked pretty well for you before such a thing was really codified in the schools you went to.
Exactly. I have a 7-year-old son now, and every day he gets a report home on how his day went, you know, and so do all his students. But at the time, when I was in kindergarten, we were having a tough time. I had a wonderful psychologist, and she had devised her own system as a graduate student to have daily communication between teacher, psychologist, and parents. And so when teachers were willing to supply these accommodations, fill out these forms, talk to her, talk to my mother, stay out in front of what was going on, you were able to diminish the harm, in a sense, some of the harm that the behavior caused. Not all the time, but in some ways. And then I ran into a teacher that wouldn't allow any of that at all. And what we saw instead was that the conflict, which, I mean, it's already very difficult behavior to deal with for any teacher. I mean, any teacher would tell you having kids that are incredibly overactive in a 35-person classroom is very, very difficult. And in this case, once we kind of lost these aids that we had had helping us forward, the symptoms really did just cause an enormous amount of conflicts.
And I was moved by the fact that you say you still have nightmares about this woman, but she essentially kind of acted like you were asking for special treatment that she clearly didn't think you deserved.
I think she saw what was going on in a moral way, you know, as she's the big Catholic hammer. And if by now we haven't learned in third grade how to do things, then it's going to come flashing down. And again, I understand in a 35-person classroom how difficult it can be, but it just happened to be a very bad mix. And I ended up spending most of the year in the hallway where my desk would be dragged every day. There were very nice nuns just across the hallway that I would talk to and hang out with, but and who had asked her to maybe have a better approach to what was going on. The nuns that ran the school, they were fantastic. But it was one of those situations where I'm sure many parents listening to the show could attest to, where you just run into an immovable variable. And because of that, everything you're working so hard to deal with suddenly becomes very, very difficult.
And you were so desperate to get out of the situation that I think without really knowing what you were doing, and we won't give the exact details because they're hard to get out of your head after you read them, but you injured yourself as a sort of cry for help.
Yeah, I remember trying to articulate what I was feeling in that moment, you know, writing from the present, writing again about the past. And this idea of making your victimhood physical, in a sense, is that if I was going to be the person who was cast outside, if I was going to spend all of this time in the hallway, and this is a moment where I just wanted to come back in the classroom, I felt that I needed to actually then be a physical victim. It was very hard. The child mind is a different mind. As one of my favorite writers says, children only see one side of an issue, and because of their lack of power, they see it with hysterical clarity. Hmm. And I think that articulates for me this strange mind that I had then, and where the emotion is so high and the impulsivity is high and the years of difficulty are adding up to this one moment. And it was an articulation of victimhood with something that's not physical, which is our personality. Like, our personalities aren't physical things, even though they can be rooted in the brain. They're mixed with experience. They're rooted in us. They're probably the most amorphous things about us. And so I think what I was thinking then as a third grader was that I wanted what was wrong, in a sense, to have a physical representation, as if that would make it more real to the teacher who, again, had been identifying everything that was going on up to that point as a matter of will.
So you have an ADHD brain, and you still do as an adult. What conclusion have you come to as to how much of your personality is part of that, or is wrapped up with that? Or do you think of ADHD as something separate from you that sort of interferes with who you would be without it?
That's a good question. And that's what a lot of the research has been in over the last 100 years, too. From my personal experience, I see intellectual development, personal development, and something like ADHD as, in a sense, or personality as three different threads. And so to give an example, I have a cousin who's a dear friend of mine and is my age and was just as overactive as I was in the classroom. But when somebody would scream at him, sit down, I need you to be quiet, he'd be like, that person's crazy. Like, why are they so angry? And I would be like, how dare you speak to me that way? Hmm. You know, and I would react backly in that way. And I think because our personalities are different, even though we're both more overactive than 95% of the population, I would say. And when it comes to adulthood, the thing about ADHD is it diminishes. It doesn't go away. Overactivity becomes more of a sense of restlessness. A lot of the attentional issues remain, and up to 60% of people that have gone through it. But the way I felt then and the physical thing I was feeling, the overactivity, the struggles with attention, those began to diminish as time went on and become something else. And so in adulthood, to even write about it, I'm writing about something I remember, but I am writing about something that in a sense for me is gone and that I no longer feel in the way I once did. And so it was very interesting to try to recreate it in narrative and in image and in scene and in moment, because I began to realize how far away it was.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Christine on the line in Dallas. Hello, Christine.
Hi. I'm very interested in your subject, but I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question. Many times ADHD is misdiagnosed with kids, and I just wanted to point out that the College of Optometrics and Vision Development, there are some extraordinary help that can be done when children's vision is checked in a way that goes beyond just can they see 20/20. And very often that makes them act out because they have tremendous trouble controlling their muscles in their eyes. There are 17 different muscles that need to be working right for a child to read, for example.
That's interesting. Can you talk, Tim, about what you learned about what else has to be ruled out before ADHD can be effectively diagnosed?
Yeah, that's a good question. Causality is the hardest thing about ADHD, it far and away, because if your child's eating, you know, a Count Chocula sugar cereal, that's not going to necessarily cause ADHD. But I think it's fair to say that diet will affect behavior in a certain way, and it's the same with vision. We do see an overdiagnosis now in ADHD as opposed to what the doctors who've been working in it for a long time would say the prevalence should be at. And a lot of that has to do with our health system. You come in for 15 minutes, you're tired, the teachers are the parents tired, the pediatrician's tired, and you're not getting the assessment in the right kind of light. And so something like vision or something like a more serious childhood mental illness disorder could be mistaken for this kind of basket or grab bag that ADHD can sometimes become. That being said, while those things can affect overactivity and attention, when it comes to what ADHD really is and what they've put pressure on it to find it to be over the past 100 years when they've been studying it, you can't create ADHD, really serious overactivity, issues with attention, simply out of thin air when it comes to experience or when it comes to diet. A lot of really good studies have been done on that. And with vision, I'm sure you may see some overactivity and some inattention, but the goal is to look at this overactivity, inattention, and impulsivity across multiple environments. And part of the diagnostic factor is that it can't just exist in one setting. It can't just be that you're overactive here, but if you're in another setting, then the overactivity is always completely gone. And that's why it's really hard to assess too, because it really asks somebody trying to identify it, whether it be a parent, teacher, or doctor, to follow the child through more than one 15-minute environment at the end of the day at the doctor's office, which is – I feel restless in that now when I bring my son in. He has a cold, you know, and it's the – it can be a stressful environment. And so I think the caller's question does do a good job getting at the difficulty of causality with it. And throughout the 20th century, people just wanted one answer. They wanted it to be diet. They wanted it to be bad parenting. You know, they wanted it to be an evolutionary defect. And it was as if they could find this one causality, then they could explain it. And often what we saw is in our quest for a single causality, we were actually just shining a line back onto what our ideology or belief systems were at that time.
Timothy Dinevi is my guest. He is nonfiction visiting writer in the MFA program at George Mason University and author of Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Timothy Dinevi about his new book, Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Let's go to the phones now, and we will hear from Mark in Denton. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Appreciate you sharing your story, Tim. I had a question. If, so far as school modifications or modifications to the classroom setting for you, if when you were in grade school, middle school, and high school, and your classroom size was half of what it was, how helpful would you have found that? And secondly, if you were to design a classroom setting or school, in fact, that would work better for youngsters with ADHD, what would that consist of?
Interesting question. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. That's an excellent question. I'll start with a story by saying that when I was 22, I moved to Honolulu and didn't have a job and had just graduated college. And I was substitute teaching at Punahou School there. And their class sizes were half. They were probably 15. And I was a substitute teacher. I was very young. I didn't, quite know what was going on. And what they allowed was for students to get up and wander around the room. Many schools do this. I've told this story before, and other people have told me that this is not necessarily something that's revolutionary or new. But I was so shocked to see a 15 or 10-person classroom and to see movement allowed within it. And if that had been available to me, I think it would have been much easier on the teachers that were involved. Because I think the teachers, it's not a matter of skill, but certain teachers just happen to manage what my specific overactivity was amid the kind of swirling nature of a 30, 35 student classroom. And so it is less pressure on the teacher themselves. And I'm sure a teacher could speak more. I only substitute taught for a little bit. That was it. But a teacher could speak much more clearly about it in terms of how that affects the difficulty of the job that they're doing. And in my experience as a child, that would have been an amazing asset for me to be able to do.
You got into some trouble in high school, but interestingly, after that was all over, for a while that led to you being socially isolated again. But that was when you discovered that you were, in fact, a very good student and could be quite engaged with your studies.
Enthusiasm has never been a problem in my situation, whether it's toward my beloved San Francisco Giants or Russian literature. And again, this gets to your earlier question, which was excellent, about personality and intelligence and overactivity and attention impulsivity. And for me, I happened to be interested in narratives. From a very early age, my father was a former baseball player. And so he was always telling wonderful stories about games and dugouts and events and these, incredibly tense moments. And then somebody would win or hit a homer or have a fake bat and it was corked that he had participated in. And I always loved those narratives, and I happened to enjoy reading those narratives. It fit my personality and me. And so when things got very difficult in high school, my friends were expelled. I was almost expelled. At a certain time, you begin to realize whether or not you might make it or you might not. And that's not necessarily what makes you continuing to go forward. But at 17 or 18, I began to realize maybe there's some things that I'm enthusiastic towards, that if I engage now to the highest degree I can, if I really turn up that enthusiasm, that maybe that can be a path forward and out, because suddenly it's not just attention. Suddenly it's not just a fist fight with a kid. Suddenly it's driving off a cliff or a knife or a gun or, drinking yourself to death. And so the stakes changed very drastically for me in 17, 18. And I'm not saying that those stakes necessarily are why things ended up okay. I could have easily have been the one who drank too much and died. But I do think that it did help me to pay attention to the idea of enthusiasm in a way I hadn't before.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Just want to say I'm trying to get this off speaker. Thank you very much.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Yes. I had two questions there. They're kind of similar. Have we been overdiagnosed with this in the last 30 years? And then have we been overprescribed? So I have a family member that's in his 30s now, a nephew. And I guess he's been on 15, 20 years. I know it's kind of an amphetamine. And it hasn't seemed to cure what's going on. In some cases, seems to have made it worse.
Any thoughts on that, Tim?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And the first part about overdiagnosis and overprescription, yes, in certain cases, because of difficulties in it, there's a lot of misdiagnosis where something else is going on, or because of the situation, the healthcare situation, the overdiagnosis. And there can be, within a medical model where there's not a lot of individuality, a quickness toward stimulants. That being said, he brought up an interesting question about how the stimulants work, if they're making things better, if they're not. When the research in ADHD began to get very interesting to me as I was reading about it was when the question began to shift to how it functions throughout the lifespan. And so initially, most people thought of ADHD as something that would go to about 20. The doctors that were researching it thought this. And then because the overactivity tended to diminish, they thought that the harms associated with whatever was going on would diminish too. And what doctors starting in the 70s started to do was follow the patients that they had that were 10, 12, all the way into adulthood and just pay attention and see what else was going on. And they found that ADHD is chronic. And so that's the same search for the single causality is often the search for a single cure. There's a big article out recently about exercise and ADHD. It's related to a study. And the headlines are often, can exercise cure ADHD? And that idea of a cure for it goes back many years. You know, dietary changes were thought to cure it in the 1970s. You know, and the scientific community did a good job and put pressure on that idea. And they saw a lot of what the caller's talking about, which is something at the border of personality or something at the border of biology and experience is very resistant to one single thing. And while stimulants can help, I have family members that have been on sustained release dextrodrine for a long time, and it really does help them. In other cases, it can make things worse. And one of the things we've got to try to remember that I've learned from going through this and from what I've read is that individuality is often what gets lost when we talk about this. We talk about numbers. We talk about society. We talk about technology. And most of the people doing the talking don't have a lot of experience with ADHD itself or haven't in the last 30 years. And so a good emphasis is this question that he's asking when he called in is sometimes it makes it better, but sometimes we can't even see if it's getting better or not. You know, and in each case, it's very different.
How does your ADHD affect the way you interact with your son now that you're a father?
Well, again, it's very different now. I think that's a good question. It's very different now. I can hide among the neurotypicals quite well, you know, with my neurotypical hat. I look great. But to answer your question, I think it gets back to the idea of enthusiasm. In my family growing up, my father worked 9 to 5. My mother would work during the day but would be more responsible for the child rearing. In my family now, my wife is a scientist and she travels a lot for her work. And so it'll often just be me and my son. And I found that, again, that enthusiasm. And I remember my mother's enthusiasm, you know, whether it's building Legos, you know, or whether it's playing wiffle ball in the backyard, you know, whatever that is, genuinely being enthusiastic about what your child's interests are have been very beneficial to me. And in addition to that, I've learned that I need to take better care of myself in simple terms of eating, exercising, making good decisions. Because if I'm having more problems because I was impulsive and ate 7 pieces of pizza or because I did something I shouldn't have done, that makes my son's life more difficult too. So being a parent has helped not just in self-regulation, but it's also been very beneficial to see what are the aspects of ADHD that for me aren't awful, aren't causing conflict at all the time. I know there's a lot of talk about the positive aspects of ADHD, but for me, there's been so much conflict for so long that sometimes I get surprised by positive aspects like that enthusiasm.
Timothy Denevi is nonfiction visiting writer in the MFA program at George Mason University, and he is author of the new book, Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. Tim, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was great.